Hello, and welcome to The Bitter End.
Hello, welcome.
Welcome. This is a podcast where we're going to watch a good film and then watch the slightly worse films that follow until they get increasingly awful.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not.
Until franchise detectives is what we are.
Yes, my name's Todd Jordan, and with me is...
Tom Denny.
We are gathered in his spare room in his palatial Brighton home, and we're here to talk about Friday the 13th, the first one, made in 1980.
Yep, and then we're going to talk about all the other ones, and right. see where it takes us.
All the way through Friday the 13th, part 2, all the way through Jason Takes Manhattan...
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. All the way through to Friday the 13th, 1, again, when they remake it. And we're going to see what this beast is all about, because the franchise is a strange beast. It's a strange reflection on the times we live in. It's just that you're staring at it, and it's staring back at you, being like, look, humanity, this is what you were back then. Or maybe, maybe not.
The franchise is indeed a harsh mistress. So just to be clear on the rules, what we're going to do is we've picked a franchise for our first season. We've picked Friday the 13th. We are including remakes in that. We're including spin-offs and crossovers. So we will be doing Freddy vs. Jason. We're stopping short of TV shows because, yes, we know that there is a Friday the 13th TV show being made. We're not going to be holding off on doing that because who knows when that will end. We're taking just the movies, including... non-theatrical releases, DVD only. The real rotters.
Yeah.
So, I have watched the original Friday the 13th before. Tom, Denny, I know that you have not watched it.
I have not seen it. Horror is not really my wheelhouse, but I am...
You're an action guy, right?
I'm an action guy, you're a horror guy, but I am delving more into horror. I'm looking forward to seeing what this guy's got in store for us.
I think you're in for a bit of a treat, buddy. So, we've just watched the trailer. We just sat down and we watched the trailer for Friday the 13th. Tom, this is a film made in 1980. Did it feel like a 1980 film to you in the trailer?
I will say yes. Being born in 1982, I can't comment with entire certainty, but yes. I don't know whether or not I now need to watch the film at all, because the trailer basically showed you pretty much every kill that is going to happen in the film.
It went on for 8,000 years, that trailer.
If you haven't seen the trailer, it's basically like, you know, the trailer voice guy counting to 13.
He counts at this speed. One.
And then someone will do two, something. Yeah.
Three.
And basically, they'll show you every shot of... I mean, I don't know if there's going to be any surprise kills in this. I guess it was a different time, so you didn't have YouTube and the dissection of trailers that you have today. You know, you just see it in the cinema and be like, oh, that's cool. There's like 13 people going to die in it. That's like way more than whatever the other film was that I saw. But it's... spoilers? That expression did not...
You know. I suppose I wonder if they really count as spoilers, because what you really just saw is a load of teenagers screaming and then freeze frames on their face and then occasionally someone holding a knife.
Do you think they're all going to be fine?
I'm not saying they're going to be fine, but I'm saying if you're going to go see a slasher movie and you're surprised that some teenagers are going to get killed...
Then no, that is fair enough. I mean, they made a lot out of the fact that, like... we can count to 13, and it seemed wholly unnecessary.
It was definitely unnecessary. They did stop short of showing what I would say is the best bit.
Okay.
So I'm hoping that all they really kind of nestled up close to showing the best bit.
Okay.
And I almost made you avert your eyes, but
I mean, there was a guy on an old man on a bike who goes, "You're doomed. You're all doomed." And I think that's pretty... that seemed pretty banging.
Rest assured, Tom, you can get a little bit more of that guy coming up when we watch the proper movie.
I hope so. I hope that he's the main protagonist.
So, quick quiz for you, Tom.
Yeah.
Quick quiz. I went on IMDb.
Ah.
Okay. The good users of IMDb, they've rated the movie out of 10. Okay.
Okay.
So, I don't know when IMDb existed. I'm going to say it's existed since 1980 when this film came out.
Yep.
So for all of time, people have been rating this film. What score do you think this movie got?
Seven. Like 7.5?
Oh, you're pretty close, man. Yeah. It's a 6.5.
A 6.5.
Which is solid. That's
solid, but that doesn't really... I mean, this has spawned a lot of other films, so...
The only way
I would expect it to be... Well, oh, fuck. Is Jason Takes Manhattan going to be a 10? I mean, I think already I'm building it up to be a 10.
There's no way. Yeah. If it's anything like The Muppets Take Manhattan.
I imagine that Jason Takes Manhattan is going to have a scene in it very reminiscent to the sort of like the final bit in Gremlins 2.
where he's going to grow wings.
Oh, no, not that bit. Like the bit where he starts singing Sinatra.
Yeah, okay. You probably will. I don't know if you ever hear Jason's voice. Maybe you do. Maybe that's coming up. Maybe we'll find out.
Maybe. I mean, if there's any Sinatra playing in the background, I'm just going to assume that it's him.
He'll just...
Or like if there's a radio playing, it's like, nah, it's just Jason. He's just singing.
He just doesn't shut up that guy.
He just really wants to sing.
So my favourite bit about the trailer was the tagline, which it does this whole thing where it yeah, counts up to 13, good. And then right at the end it says, "You may only see it once, but that will be enough."
Doesn't really sound like it's really selling the film.
No, that's not a good thing. So when there's like, "You may only see it once," I was like, okay, cool, that means maybe I'll die of fright or something before it's over. But then the latter bit is just like, you won't want to see it again.
Yeah, or it's like, "You'll see it once, that'll do, it's okay." You know when there's like...
It's a solid 6.5.
Yeah, it's basically... I guess they hadn't got the IMDb rating yet, so they couldn't put that on the tag.
Yeah. But, okay.
Yeah.
So
let's watch the film.
Let's watch the film. We're going to dive in. We are going to spend a good period of time watching this movie for you guys. We're going to make some notes, and then we're going to reconvene... And we're gonna
You've seen this already, so you know how you feel about it. I'm expecting nothing less than a solid. Well, I said it was going to be 7.5. I've got high hopes for this.
On the Todd Jordan personal scale, I would give this movie an 8.5. I'm a fan. I'm excited for you to watch it for the first time.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Boom.
So, we have just watched Friday the 13th, part one.
It's a romp. It's definitely a romp. I thoroughly have never seen that before. Thoroughly enjoyed that. I think 6.5 on IMDb is a bit harsh.
That's a crime.
It was great. I really enjoyed it. I can see, like, it's pretty quintessential in terms of, like, slasher tropes and things, and you know, could do a lot worse.
Could do a lot worse, and I think that, you know, with the amount of sequels that we have to plow through, we will discover a lot worse. But it feels good because it feels that we're starting high, and you know, I've seen a lot worse films than Friday the 13th Part One, and then gone to go see the sequel, knowing that it would still be worse. So
yeah,
we're starting high. We've got a lot of wiggle room.
Yeah, a lot of wiggle room. Let me just say, we've been making notes. Let's have a look. The first note that I made on my notebook says "wholesome pussies," which is basically that. So like the film opens in like 1950-something.
50-something, 53,
in Camp Crystal Lake, where the film takes place. And the camp counselors are basically a bunch of wholesome pussies. They're just all sat around singing basically like hymns on an acoustic guitar. And then like two of the counselors, they slope off to, you know.
A little.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the point. There's, I think, the first 15 to 20 minutes of this film, to me, looked very much like sort of like, I don't know, like a 70s softcore porn film. Like at any moment, someone was going to like take off their shirt and like the funk music was going to come in and
That was definitely on the cards. But the key thing is that when the two kids were boning in the log cabin,
they
didn't take any clothes off.
Yeah, they were having hot shorts on top of shorts action. But yeah, I mean, you know, and they deserve to die for that, clearly. But there were also like other moments. There were just, I think, just because of like the caliber of acting in this film is there are some erotic movie quality performances in there, and especially later on in the film when you're introduced to the guy who owns the camp, and he's wearing incredibly tight cut-off denim shorts, like sort of like Timberland boots, a red neckerchief, and a thick bushy moustache,
and calf socks,
and he's just there like hacking like a wooden stump with an axe, and then pervs on somebody. It's just like there's a very creepy under. Maybe it's me reading things into it, but
no, you know. I think that's kind of important for the film, though, because I think you're supposed. We were kind of playing the game while we were watching it, of who do we think the filmmakers want us to suspect, kind of as it was going on,
yeah,
and you know, as it's no secret, I've seen the film before. I know who the killer is. Tom hadn't seen the film before. You know who the killer was anyway, because you've seen Scream for a start. Like one of the most famous speeches in the film, Scream, spoils the ending of this film. So
yeah,
but I think it's still possible to kind of enjoy it knowing.
Yeah, because I was just interested to see how they were going to introduce this character. Like, I mean, I guess we're going to spoil the film. Are we spoiling this?
Okay.
Well, actually, I think since we're going to talk about every film in the series, I think that we probably can spoil.
All right, it's, spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Don't listen to this if you don't want to know. It's not Jason Voorhees, the perceived star of all the Friday the 13th films. It's Mama Voorhees avenging Jason's death, drowning in the camp back in 19...
avenging his death because he drowned while the counselors were off having sex, so hence the porny nature.
Yes, so it's a big shame piece. It's like slut shaming horror or something. But it, where was I driving with this? I can't remember where were we? We got off piste.
They're talking about the creepy counselor, camp owner.
I mean, they're introducing him as a potential. He's going to be the one that does it. He's the creep, and like they've established that a lot of bad things have gone at this camp, so maybe it's going to be him. I mean, the filmmakers are actually very sneaky in that they've made it a whodunit where they give you absolutely no indication of who would have done it at all at any point during the film until they show up. Like, you know, like you couldn't possibly guess if you know, like in 1980 went to the cinema and were kind of like, I bet it's gonna be that guy, and it's like, no, it's none of them, it's instead this character that no one has seen or heard of, and then they show up in the last 15 minutes of the film.
That is a fucking lightning turnaround that they do on Mrs. yeah. Voorhees as well. So, just to recap, because it may have been a little while since you guys have seen the film. We've seen it within the last 1 minute, so I'm going to do this for you now. The main girl, the final girl, she's the final girl. She's in the log cabin. She's discovered that her mates are dead. She's, like, locked herself in. She does this whole elaborate thing where she piles up all the furniture against the door, even though the door opens outwards, so... piling up the furniture will do no good at all. And then there's someone turns up, and it's Mrs. Voorhees, this character that we've never seen before.
Looking very Angela Lansbury-esque in a very nice knit jumper.
Yeah,
really
pastel
good.
Baby blue jumper, nice car.
She's to be trusted.
The girl, the final girl, she runs out, she gives her a big hug, and she goes, "Oh, my friends are dead." And the girl says, "Don't be silly.
You're exaggerating
how dead they are." And she goes, "No, they really are all dead." And then she says, "Well, let's go in and have a look at them." And then I think it's like 45 seconds before she goes, "Yeah, I used to work at this camp. Yeah, my son died here because everyone was off having sex. Yeah, it's their fault. By the way, here's my knife. What do you think of that? By the way, let's have it, yeah." It's like the most lightning turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really do anything to hide. Like, as soon as, because when we're watching the film, you asked me, like, so if you didn't know, would you have guessed that she is going to be the killer? And I was like, yes, absolutely. There is absolutely, it's so thinly veiled, like, her attempt to be trustworthy. And then you're also kind of like, I mean, at this late stage of the game, who the hell is this person? They've got to be the killer, because who else can, all other characters are dead. I mean, oh well, there were some other good secondary characters in this film. But maybe we're getting ahead of, I mean, well.
Well, one of the things I've written down, actually, the very first note I made is there are no stars in this film, which, except for, yeah, obviously looking through the eyes of history, like, you've got Kevin Bacon, but that guy, at the time, he wasn't really anybody, so.
But he's like the Johnny Depp in Nightmare on Elm Street, that he's just kind of there to be like, hey, I'm pretty and well,
and then, blah, and, now I'm dead.
And then he's dead.
Yeah. So the most famous person in it was Mrs. Voorhees, so there would have even been like that extra element, I guess, when she crops up, you're like, I know her, she's like an actual proper actress.
She is an actual proper
she
actress.
She must not be cheap.
And I read a few little bits of trivia about her and her role in the film. And she was saying that, like, when the film came out, she said that it was, the script was a pile of shit, and she only did it because she needed a new car.
That's a fair reason.
And that, because she was like a, you know, like a proper like stage actress and quite well thought of, so her doing this film was a bit of a coup, bit of an upset in the, you know, in the acting community, and that there was this reviewer who, like, I think, like, posted her address in a review and said you should write to her and say, you know, and voice your complaint that she's doing this film. But he actually posted the wrong address. So somebody would have just been receiving all this mail.
Doxing from the past. Yeah,
dear Mar Voorhees, you shouldn't have done this. I hadn't bothered to learn what her name was, so I'm just going to call her Mar Voorhees.
I think it's literally just Mrs. No, I want to say Pamela Voorhees. I think that's her name.
Okay.
Spooky name.
No, Pam. Spooky Pam.
Pammy V.
So, yeah, basically, just to, like, put the plot down. I mean, there's not much of a plot, but the kids, there's a summer camp, what's it called, Camp Crystal Lake, and yeah, some bad things have gone down there in the past. Seems like literally everybody has died that's ever gone there, and the people in the town call it Camp Blood, and yet they still keep on opening it. And they're ready for their big reopening. So porn star owner has hired a bunch of teenagers to be the counselors and soup the place up, ready for the kids. And then everybody dies. And that's basically, that's the plot. But, you know, what a ragtag cast they've got.
Along the way, you've got Crazy Ralph from the town.
He shows up and says, "Yeah, you do, was it? It's got a death curse on it.
Everything's got a death curse.
We were sort of toying with the idea, because like a cop says, like, oh, Ralph has gone missing, his wife's gone crazy. It's like, so, like, this crazy guy has got his wife home somewhere. It's like, oh my God, where's Ralph gone? He's off telling everyone there's death curses on everything. And then Ralph's like, oh, my wife's got a death curse on her. That was nice. He was, I've got my, like, he's one of my top three characters.
So who were your top three characters?
So Ralph was a big un. There is the truck driver who isn't Tom Bosley, but I think would have made a very good living as a Tom Bosley impersonator if there was indeed a market for that.
That is Tom Bosley, the dad from Happy Days, right?
Yeah, Tom Bosley, the dad from Happy Days. He's great. Like, there's a bit at the beginning. So the film opens with, like, one of the counselors. She gets to the town. He's like, does anyone know how to get to where to get to Crystal Lake? In this diner, and everyone in the diner goes really quiet, and like, ooh. And one of them says, "You mean Camp Blood?" And then, like, they all, like, look, give me all these shifty looks, and, like, Tom Bosley's like, "I'll give you a ride," and then she's gonna give him a ride, and then Ralph shows up and says, "Ah, oh, it's got a death curse," and then Tom Bosley is like, "Your boss has got to hate that guy Ralph because he's given the place such a bad rep." And then he gets in the car and proceeds to tell the girl a load of exposition about how she shouldn't work there and everyone has died at that camp. And it's kind of like, you can't really rag on Ralph when you've just been hanging out with a bunch of people that call the place Camp Blood, and then you've just gone on this like whole kind of like, here's the potted history of all the death that has happened in this camp. So I liked Tom Bosley. He's like, you know, holier than thou, like Ralph, he's a nutter, but here, let me tell you about some moiders.
Yeah,
he was good. He was good. Could have done with more of him. I think he could also have had a spin-off. Him and Ralph, I think, should have spin-offs.
Bit more Ralph in the mix. And because he had a good hat. He had a good grimace. Hat. And I like the fact he just rode a push bike everywhere, which was kind of crucial, I thought, because again, when we were playing the game of like, who's the murderer, who are we supposed to think the murderer is?
Mm.
There's a lot of like hype up of like crazy Ralph from the town. The guy's crazy. But there's a bit early on where the very first kill that happens actually in the woods, which is like a pretty decent kill. There's a throat slitting against a tree, but that happens based on like there's a hitchhiker situation where someone's driving a car and then the person driving the car turns out to be the killer. You don't see who it is. It's all POV. But then later when we see Ralph driving his push bike.
Can't have been him.
He can't have been him because he's riding a bike there.
So who could it be?
Who could it be?
It's probably some character we're never going to be introduced to at any point during the film until the final act.
Until 45 seconds before they're revealed to be the killer.
Yeah. My other top three characters. Number three is the cop that shows up for no reason.
You mean the cop that says, Colombian gold, man, grass, hash, the weed.
Yes, he's... I have no idea why he showed up or what he was doing there. Police just seem to show up arbitrarily during this film and do nothing. But, I mean, for like a very small town, they have a lot of police and they seem very active. That's great for them. But this policeman shows up while... I don't know. I have absolutely no idea why he's there. Is it because Ralph has been about?
It's because Ralph's gone missing. They've gone to go try and find Ralph.
At this point, people have no respect for the law, man. So like there's a character, one of the counts is called Neddy. He is the Joker. So if you've seen like my references are going from Scream, that you've got like the jokey guy. He is like the archetypal jokey guy.
He's the Matthew Lillard type.
Yeah, and I've got a note here saying, what is he compensating for? Why is he being such a douchebag and like making all these terrible gags? There's a bit in the film where he pretends to drown quite convincingly and freaks all of his friends out, and they think that he's going to die, and he does it so he can get mouth to mouth and get a bit of a reach around from Kevin Bacon's girlfriend. It's kind of like, god damn, what is he trying to make up for by with this hideous behaviour. But anyway, when the policeman shows up, he is for some reason wearing a Native American headdress and underpants and just like is just being quite offensive. And I just like that scene because you're like three village people short of a village people reunion with like the cop and the Native American. So that was... I mean, I don't think that was necessarily what the filmmakers intended.
It was Tom
from that scene, and then Kevin Bacon shows up and is just kind of like, hey, cool bike police guy, and then the police guy's, hey, what you smoking there? Is it the grass, the hash? And it's like, what is the purpose of this scene? Is it, was that what everyone was doing in 1980? I don't know. Anyway, we should probably move on from that's my top three characters. They were all of very little consequence in the real scheme of the film.
Well, look, man,
which is telling of like how much we get to know about any of the central characters, which is nothing, absolutely nothing.
I certainly do not want to pick holes in this film because
I'm not saying I don't like it.
I'm saying it's a tippity-top-notch film.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I want to talk a little bit about what Friday the 13th Part 1 does the best. I wanted to give you my rundown.
Please do.
Of the top three deaths.
Oh, there were some good ones.
Okay, in reverse order.
Yeah.
Controversial.
Mm.
Most famous one, Kevin Bacon. Arrow through the back of the neck, through the mattress of the bed. He's all post-coital, he's chilling out.
Mm.
Arrowhead from under the bed sticks up through the back of the neck, comes out his throat. Very bloody, very Kevin Bacon.
I would agree with that.
Very iconic. I like it. That's number three.
I agree. That is a solid three. It's not the best.
I like it because shortly before that, there's a massive extended close-up of his naked bottom.
And the very tasteful shot sex scene. And
his girlfriend like gripping his bum is like the main thing that you see in that. And then he's like, oh, I'm all chilled out from having my bum squeezed. We're just going to lie down here and just like take it easy for a minute. And then up it goes.
Can I ask you a quick side note about Kevin Bacon?
Please do.
Do people think that Kevin Bacon is an attractive man, or is everyone being ironic?
Because he's very impish.
He's an odd-looking fellow. He looks like someone made a sculpture and they couldn't get it quite right.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's something a bit off about him. And I've never really sure of, like, whether people like Kevin Bacon out of, like, a genuine thing.
I think he looks good in 1980. I think he looks all right.
But he almost looks, you know, like he's been, like, made out of wax or something.
Yeah,
he's
slightly melting wax, but handsomely.
Yeah, handsomely melting. Okay, anyway. Second death. Please.
Okay, so final death. Pamela Voorhees, Mrs. Voorhees, getting her head chopped off by the final girl on the side of the lake with the machete, comes out of nowhere, and just the sort of serrated, like the bit when her head actually falls off, she's left with like this amazing kind of, I'm going to call it a neck stump.
There's no There's no blood.
There's no spurting.
Yeah.
No, there's none of that. That would be gauche. Mm. Instead, what she does is like the... I don't know how they did it, but like Sean S. Cunningham, the director, obviously just said, can you just hold your hands up as if you're saying, why?
Yeah.
Why?
It basically is like... I don't know, to give it a slightly more modern reference, it's a bit like the bit where they spoiled Darth Vader at the end of Revenge of the Sith, where Darth Vader goes, no! It's like the proper, like, no! Like, she's in deep inside. She's like, ah, she cut my head off. No, my one weakness.
But she can't say no because she has no head. Like, so it's the ultimate irony.
There's just this, like, hissing sound of her trying to say no.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I mean, I think that that could have been a number one, but
could have been a number
one. I think I know what your number one is.
For me, you know, I loved it. Right after Kevin Bacon gets the arrow in the neck, his girlfriend, girl in the pink top, axe in the face. Now, it's not just the axe in the face, although the axe in the face is pretty strong, Tom.
It's pretty heavy.
It's the editing of the scene. There's like, it's a three-shot kill, as far as I'm concerned. So you see a shot of her like looking out the window. She's heard a noise or something. She looks out the window. She goes, oh, I guess it's nothing. And then right when she says that, you see the shadow on the wall behind her that she can't see of this axe being raised.
Mm.
And then she closes the curtains and turns around. Next shot, she's screaming, but she does a weird scream, which you would never ever do if someone had an axe up in front of you, where she has her hands firmly down by her sides, not trying to protect herself at all, and she just goes, ah!
she's like firmly resigned herself to the fact, like, it wasn't how I thought I'd go, but I guess this is it. She's just like, no.
Fair play to you. And then the third shot, blah! Pow! Right in the kisser. But it's like diagonal across her forehead, like between her nose and her eye. And the axe goes in really deep. And it's just pretty brutal.
It is. I was surprised at quite how visceral the kills would be.
How early on in the film that one is as well.
Yeah. The kills in the film like go on at quite a lick. There's a little bit of build-up. The first person that gets killed is this hitchhiker. She gets the lift with Tom Bosley. And I thought that she was going to be the main character. But no, she's a fake out. She dies. And they're like, well, who the hell else is it going to be? I guess they get to introduce us to whoever the main character is going to be. There's not really a lot of that. They are literally fodder being offed in rather fun and jaunty ways. And then we were kind of like, as well as playing the game of like, so, you know, guess like, you know, how the filmmakers are trying to like make you think like, who's the killer? We were like, so who's going to live here? Who is meant to be the protagonist? Who is the main character? Because there isn't, you know, they are just like kids. And it's like, well, she'll be okay. And we figured out like, she's the one that's going to be okay. Because she was like, I think I should go. She's like, I don't think I really want to work at this job because the guy with the red neckerchief and no shirt on keeps on trying to perv onto me. I've got a bad feeling about this place. How right she was.
So we talked about the trailer and how they did the weird counting thing up to 13. So I did make a note of like how many kills there are.
Oh, yeah,
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Including Mrs. Voorhees?
8, 9 with Mrs. Voorhees, 10, because actually the two counts at the beginning I counted as one. So it's 10. So what was that trailer going on about?
That's a good point. You were robbed. I suppose you could...
They just really wanted to focus... You know, what's the most important thing about this film that we have to drive home? It's got to be the number 13 in the title.
Well, that is an interesting thing, because they say, oh, it's set on Friday the 13th. Unlucky for some. But no one in the film ever says, unlucky for some, or anything like that.
Yep.
There's just this throwaway line. The only reason it's set on Friday the 13th is when Mrs. Voorhees says that it's Jason's birthday.
Yeah.
But presumably she would have been killing then anyway, because she doesn't want the camp to reopen.
Yeah.
So is that just a coincidence? So then why mention it?
I don't know. It's a bit, I mean, I guess they were like, well, we've got the rights to a spooky title, so we need to work it in there somewhere.
They got the rights, like someone owns Friday the 13th.
Yeah, there are a load of guys all like go around Hollywood with pitches for like a film called Friday the 13th. And they're like, no, we got to get ours into production first, so we can like, I wanted to ask you. So the trailer does say you only need to see it once, but that'll be enough.
Mm.
And you've watched it at least twice.
I've watched it twice.
Was that more than enough?
I enjoyed it more the second time, and I loved it the first time.
Okay, those marketing guys were selling themselves short.
I would return to you, though. You have seen it once. Is that enough?
I would watch it again. I think that was a lot of fun. I know we need to, you know, bring this baby on home, but I got a few little notes here.
Yeah.
So I would say that from the track record, Camp Crystal Lake, I would liken it to Jurassic Park in terms of just like relentlessly reopening a business that just seems to kill people all the time. I don't know, that was just a little parallel that I got there, because it's like the camp had been open since the 30s and we're not in the 1980, we're in the present.
That is a really interesting point.
That's when the film says we're in the present, so I assume it's going on in 2015.
Yeah,
right?
The film is absolutely, the main events of the film taking place on whatever day you happen to be watching the film.
Very confusing, as we are not watching it on Friday the 13th.
No, or in 1980.
It's weird. Yeah, I just kind of thought it's like, the camp's been open for like 30 years, since the 1930s. And, I mean, a lot of people seem to have died there.
Only since the 50s, when there was the terrible accident with
Jason Voorhees. So they had like a good 20-year run of like...
Good 20 years of minor sprains.
Year one, no one died.
Bad splinter here and there.
Yeah. Then there's a few other like little bits that kind of caught my eye in the film. There's a strip Monopoly game.
Oh, mate, we have to... I literally have the note. I wrote down, we have to talk about strip Monopoly.
And so basically, like... The whole thing, I mean, from what I gathered from this, American summer camps are just lawsuits waiting to happen. Because it's just people just like, what I'm going to do is I'm going to employ a bunch of randy teenagers who are just going to get high, drunk, and get it on with each other. And get them to look after children. And it seems like, well, that sounds like a fucking nightmare. Like someone's going to die, maybe someone called Jason. So it seems like a terrible business model, doing the old summer camp thing. But then also, like, it just seems, I just don't really see the appeal of basically, like, what do you want to do with your summer? Spend it in a shed, and all we've got to do is sit around and listen to my mate play classical guitar and then maybe play Monopoly. No, not Monopoly. You'll like the way I play it. Strip Monopoly. It still looked really boring. And like all games of Monopoly, they didn't finish it.
They didn't. And not one of them actually took all of... maybe one of them took all of their clothes off. Because then it started to rain and the girl...
No, the guy got just down to his jeans.
Mm.
Oh, no, there was a girl in... Was she in, like, her underwear? I don't know.
She put, like, a mac on, which kind of defeats the object of...
Well, it was just that, like, she took all of her clothes off in the room, and then she's like, I'm off to bed, I'll leave my clothes here, I'll just put this Macintosh on over my underwear and walk out into the rain. So anyway, I just thought the idea of strip Monopoly, I think even just adding the strip element into Monopoly doesn't make Monopoly any more of an appealing concept.
Like, no, I get that, yeah.
Like, it still seems like that's going to be a really long and tedious evening, and by the time you probably get round to anything interesting, you're just going to be like, oh, I really don't care. It's like, we've been playing this game for like 4 hours.
They were getting high as well, which I don't think is something that improves Monopoly necessarily. I don't think that Monopoly and getting high are two sort of happy bedfellows.
Yeah. So that was just like a little interesting side note. You know, they were trying to get the strip Monopoly movement going. And then there's also just like my last little note here is like about the snake scene.
Mm. Oh God, the snake scene.
Yeah. So,
do you want to set up the snake scene for the listener?
You go for the snake scene, and I'll tell you that. Then I can tell you the bit that I found interesting about the snake.
It's an additional kill that we forgot to list earlier, really. Whereas it's quite early on in the film when they're kind of trying to, I guess the filmmakers are trying to kind of underpin the fact that camp is a dangerous place. You know, it's you're wild. You're surrounded by nature, and it's one of the only scenes that's in daytime. And one of the girls goes into her room in the camp and there is a snake there, and literally every person that she has ever met apparently bundles into the cabin to help her with this snake. And then the boring man that was playing strip poker with their strip Monopoly, who has no name or personality, apparently is just holding a machete.
He just runs in and goes, what's the matter?
Oh, good thing I've got this machete here. And he just chops the absolute shit out of this snake, and it's a real snake that they really cut up, which I don't think is that cool, guys.
No, it's not really. Yeah, that doesn't really fly.
Yeah.
It adds a bit of a dark tone.
It's the most brutal kill in the
it
film.
Is it's pretty brutal. And then, but like the other thing, this was just kind of like, aside from like that kind of like unpleasantness, is that like they're just, the way all these people are dealing with the snake is, was just like, they all, like about five or six people, stuck their head under the bed where the snake was, and they were like, oh my God, is this a dangerous snake? And then Kevin Bacon proceeds to like knock over the bedstand, like the side table, and jumps on the bed. It's like, hey, I've got an idea, I'll drive it out, by basically just like twatting everything over in the room.
Just by being a dick.
And then one of the girls basically gets, like, a couple of girls get pillows out, and they essentially try and start a pillow fight with the snake. It's just like it's probably like bashing these feather pillows, and feather pillows are all over the room, and it's kind of like, is this like turning into like a Benny Hill sketch? And then it all gets brought crashing back down to reality just by like hacking this poor snake up.
Maybe that's what they were trying to do. Maybe they were trying to do that on purpose, kind of underpin the sort of the levity, the teenagers away from their parents.
Could you imagine if they put the Benny Hill score in there, and you know, like if they're having the pillow fight and Kevin Bacon's like knocking everything over, and then it's like, bam, done. And then they bring in the soundtrack that's basically ripping off the soundtrack to Psycho, which the soundtrack for this does it heavily.
It's just the Psycho theme. I mean, no, yeah, it suits the movie really well, and it's got this really nice like recurring thing in the music where you got just the Psycho theme going, dun, 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 and then someone just really quietly goes, kill, kill.
There's an echo
on it.
I mean, the film is essentially Psycho in reverse, like in terms of it being, it's like, instead of it being like, what if the mum was, you know, the mum was dead, it's the other way around. It's like the mum's the killer. And it's on the, you know, and I think that the summer camp was a really good setting for this thing. I mean, I'm interested to see how long they're going to string out the summer camp setting.
Now I have not seen part two.
I know at some point we will go to Manhattan, and I know at some point we will go to hell,
and at some point we will go to space.
We will go to space. What about space?
That's, we've got a lot of sequels
so
to go through.
So I mean, that was a very unstructured dissection of the film.
No.
But in, you know, to recap, I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to seeing how the rest of this plays out. I want you to guess. So where do you think where's it gonna really hit the skids? Like how much longer can we maintain?
Okay.
Because the thing is, we haven't had Jason Voorhees yet.
No.
So I have a feeling that like the next one is still gonna be good, because it's gonna do something. It's got to be, well, it's got a different edge to it. Because at the end of the film, it introduces suddenly this curveball supernatural element of Jason. So, like, that was a real shocker to
me. Jason's in the lake. He's in the lake.
Yeah. I thought that they were going to introduce that beginning of film two. And, like, this was going to be that thing of, like, it's a contained film. There we go. And then they're going to have to try and find some way to turn, like, to do a sequel. Mm. But this was, like, actually very, like... You know, they've thought about this. They're like, oh, they've set up, like, there's something there. And it's really weird because, like, oh, there's, like, a supernatural element in this, in a film that has no supernatural elements in it whatsoever. Suddenly they've dropped it in at, like, the last minute of the film.
And it is harrowing when it happens. The very tail end of this film, guys, like, I urge you to revisit it if it's been a little while since you've watched it, just because from the moment where Mrs. Voorhees' head comes off... to the moment that the credits actually start to roll, it's like, yeah, it's like an art film. It's weird and slow-mo. And
yeah, it's great. Like, the ending was fantastic. And I just was like, oh, what? I didn't see all that coming. So so I think that two will be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe four... we're going to get into some dark because this is a franchise where they tried to finish it several times and then brought it back. So I think four.
I agree with you. I think four is where things are going to start to get a little stinky, a little sticky.
I think that Corey Feldman appears at about three or four.
I did not know that.
So...
okay, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
That's going to be a zinger.
Okay, so just before we properly wrap up, what do you want to see in Friday the 13th Part 2?
I don't know, probably just more of the same, I guess.
I don't know if you're going to get more of the same.
More of the same, but with a big burly guy? I mean, I think I will get more of the same because there's going to be a load of kids being killed in a summer camp. But I think maybe the next film will be a bit different. Like, it took a very long time for... the heroine to realise that everyone was dead. I don't think that's going to hold up as much.
Nah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just want to see where this takes me. I just can't wait to get to space.
All right, we'll leave it there. space, here we come.
Space is the place.
Thanks for listening very much. This is the Bitter End, first episode. My name is Todd Jordan.
I'm Tom Denny.
Tune in next time where we'll be listening to Friday the 13th, Part 2.
Woo!